will most rapidly assist us to overcome the negative factors of our own temperaments and bring our own personality onto an even keel. Unless we do this, we must go for help to various psychological groups, some of which, unfortunately, can do very little in long-range planning for the individual. They may be able to get him over an immediate crisis, but he will fall into another almost immediately because he has no remedy against crisis in himself. And it is this basic remedy that we most deeply require. Now, in this emergency, we are beginning to look everywhere. We're looking in many places where 50 years ago we would not have turned a glance. And we are reminded also that both Spengler and Toynbee, two of our great historical philosophers, have come to the conclusion that we are moving into a curious philosophic era, an era in which necessity is bringing or forcing a philosophy upon us. And while neither of these men wished to come right out and say what this philosophy would be, because for both of them the historical factor was difficult, we can't pick a philosophy of long ago and simply drop it on ourselves here. We have to take philosophic principles and reapply them, but preserve the values. And both of these men were of the opinion that ultimately Western man would drift more and more into a strongly Asiatic philosophical point of view. The only reason for this probably is that Asia has remained as the only area in which philosophic principles have continued to be alive, and where the religious principles which most involve man are not archaic. Our religion must be approached historically. In many of the Asiatic countries, what occurred 2,000 years ago in the West is occurring today. Therefore, there is a contemporary possibility of analysis and consideration. Now, it is not by any means obvious that the Eastern nations have solved their problems or have completely brought their own worlds into pattern. But we are dealing now not with collectives, not with the imposing of one political theory upon another. We are not dealing with the price of rice or the scarcity of water. We are dealing essentially with the problem of the individual who has to get up tomorrow morning and face life. Now, he has got to face life with the best possible equipment. And we know that the only type of equipment today that will help him is that by which he is equipped to examine himself, to go into his own nature and find out why he is what he is. The moment we say, go in and look, we come sharply against the boundary of Western culture. Western culture has been a gay extroversion for a long time. It has been very gay, but nobody seems to be very happy about it. Western culture has been to move out into the world around us and try to shape it to our heart's desire. Western culture has been done very little in the actual examination into the inner life of the human being. Most of what has been done has been comparatively materialistic effort to crash through from the outside in terms of psychology and psychiatry. But actually, we have less than 50 years, probably, in the West of any systematic effort to really do anything with man's inner life. And what we have accomplished is not adequate. On the other hand, we have a philosophy on the other side of the world in which the inner life has been so important that many outer things have been miserably neglected. So we come into the presence of extremes. But at the moment we need something, and we need something very definitely. We do not need the mistakes of other people, but we do need whatever they have accomplished that might be a guide to our own action. We do need something at the moment to balance an extensive and over-intensive materialism. And materialism does not necessarily mean just the scientific or industrial or economic worlds. Materialism has crept also very heavily into Western religion and has heavily indoctrinated Western philosophy. Consequently, we are in trouble. And in our search for some answer, we have to look to the only place where we think we can find some rudiments to build up with. We do not intend necessarily to follow the way of another people, because actually we are a Western culture. But what we need is some way in which we can get hold of what might be termed our natural culture pattern. Bring it out and use it. And the only way we know is by calling upon people who have brought internals out and done something about it. And that does bring us more or less toward the Asiatic point of view. Because here at least we have somebody who tried. And for a long time we have not been adequately trying. The adaptation cannot be entire or complete, and I don't think there's any need to consider the entire transference as religious. I don't think we should regard the development of man as a theological problem. That's been one of our mistakes. We have thought that the individual who was good had certain religious benefits from being good. I think it more important than that, that the individual who is good, in the sense of proper virtuous understanding, is simply right. And because he is right, he is cooperating with the universe, with life, with nature, and his fellow man. But these things are not great religious virtues. They are nothing more or less than human decency. But we haven't gotten around to such a factual look at it. So it isn't necessary for us to think that we are going to follow some foreign creed. What we are looking for is the instrumentation of personal culture. We are looking for the implementing of our own conviction of need so that we're able to do something about it. Self-expression certainly is indicated. And self-expression has helped many people all over the world. And self-expression can move into the life of the individual without causing any panic, without causing him to lose face with his neighbor, or without requiring some stupendous expenditure which he cannot afford. Self-expression is perfectly possible to the individual in any bracket of income. It is a problem of moving the internal part of life and getting it moving out into action so that the person is moved by the principles within himself. Now, a lot of people who try this, however, get into another dilemma. They are unable to estimate what is moving or why they are being pressured in a certain way. It is not enough to say that if we simply follow internal inclination as we know it, that we're going to get anywhere. Because too many people today have a powerful internal inclination to be unpleasant. Also, most people have a very overwhelming inclination to be selfish. This, therefore, is not the answer, that we merely do what we feel like doing. We'll never get anywhere that way. We have to go behind this. So we do learn immediately from Eastern philosophies that there are two sources of inner pressure. The most common and available source is just plain selfishness. The deeper and more important source is the universal law complex within ourselves, in which there is at the source and root of ourselves an archetypal pattern, through the acceptance and application of which we are true to the plan for ourselves. So we have to try to figure out how to get at the real one. How to substitute universal purpose for self-purpose. How we can achieve obedience to the universe rather than obedience to our own selfishness. to accomplish this, there has to be a certain amount of effort. But if there is no effort, naturally, all reward is less. That which is most difficult or most rare is most highly valued. And what we are searching for is the most valuable thing in the world, peace of spirit. Therefore, we cannot buy it cheaply, and it will not be discounted after the first of the year. We have to work with it. The thoughtful person can work with it by using a simple code of personal attitude. We can use the mind as it was intended to be used, namely, as a sensor of conduct. The purpose of the mind is not to take part in the conspiracy of selfishness. The purpose of the mind is to reveal to us the constructive results of constructive action and the destructive results of destructive action. The mind makes available to us the facts about the consequences of what we do. If then we are really inclined to be in search of self-creativity, we must begin to use the mind to reveal to us what is wrong with ourselves. Up to now, we've always used it to find out what was right about ourselves and what was wrong about everyone else. Also, in emergencies, we use the mind as an escape mechanism. We try to talk ourselves in and out of things. We use the mind to develop explanations that explain nothing. We also use it in the mind for various self-justifications, for things that cannot factually be justified. So the mind is available to us as a simple instrument by which we can think through our own conduct. We can very quietly decide whether what we are doing is right or wrong. This comes first because we have to clear the way. The road that leads in to the sanctuary in our own hearts has been so neglected that it is practically impassable. You can't bring people in this road. You can't travel it yourself because it has been so long neglected that it is worse than any provincial road in some aboriginal community. In fact, it's one of those problems like you find in Africa sometimes where it is much easier to travel if you stay off the road. This is the problem we have. The road is in very bad shape. To get this road back into condition, we have to begin to repair it. And one of the ways that we must use to repair it is to make sure that we know when and how to demand and require and to what degree we are able to get rid of the false situations, which are blind alleys on roads that lead nowhere. Many people have sincerely, earnestly, and honorably followed a road that led nowhere, simply because they had no discrimination. They did not use the mind to help them. We have allowed the mind to hinder us for thousands of years, but it is here because it could help us. And one of the ways in which it can help us is to censor our attitude and conduct. So we begin with the only way that we know how to begin. We all have moral sense. We all have certain inner conviction. We have all, to some degree, a traditional religious background. We know about the Sermon on the Mount, and we know of the revelation of the Ten Commandments. We know the essential codes of right that have been exercised and promulgated by man from the beginning of known time. We also recognize as a fact that those who have kept these rules have become the most gracious, constructive, and valuable of citizens. Consequently, we're not completely without some help. The problem is to bridge between this help and our own natures. So we start out in the morning quite convinced that we are self-motivating creatures, but in the majority of cases, the motivation arises in the liver or in the suprarenal cortex. There doesn't seem to be very much true motivation. So today, we are hardly able to crawl along under this motivation. We are tired before we start and exhausted before we finish. But we do start out, and we almost immediately begin to sense that our conduct is inconsistent with value. It is not getting us there. We know that when we become a little impatient early in the morning, it isn't good, but we can't help it. As we go a little further through the day, the impatience increases. Somebody does something or says something that isn't pleasant, we're either angry or offended. If we are angry, we say something unpleasant ourselves and consider that that is a solution. We are trying to fight one poison with another. Or if we're hurt, we mood and brood over it and finally collapse in a state of self-pity. We do this. Then we go out and we start to do some things we regard as important. Our mind isn't really on the things we're doing. We take 10 steps where one would be sufficient. We haven't organized. We meet each new issue of the day with a large measure of aggressiveness or belligerence. Nothing is moving smoothly. Nothing is done simply in a natural way because it is something to be done. Everything is heavy with overtones and undertones of a negative nature. We won't go along more than an hour in the morning before the mind will report this to us. That begins to present a problem. The only answer seems to be to turn to the mind as we would to a small child and say, shish. We don't want to hear the news. So we turn on the television and get worse news. We do not want to hear the mind tell us that we're stupid. After it has told us a few million times, we think it's a nagger. And finally, the mind, in general despair, gives up. It also becomes educated badly by our own attitudes and becomes so toxic with our own self-pity and selfishness that it can no longer function. But most thoughtful people still have some function there. So when these reports come in, what is the other thing to do? The other thing to do is to say that here is where education begins. Education is not a matter of schooling, it's a matter of listening. It's a matter of listening to the need of self. So after we have had one of these tempests in the teapot, which makes up the life of most people, we can pause and say, just what is all this about? Why is this so necessary? Why is it that when we feel like doing a certain thing or thinking a certain thought, there is absolutely nothing we can do about it, except do what we feel like doing? What would we do if we tried to bring up children the way we bring up our own thoughts and feelings? We would have a group of delinquents. Therefore, we have a group of delinquent thoughts and feelings. But what we don't realize is that there is never one moment in life when these thoughts and feelings, bad or impossible as they may be, are actually self-motivating. They have no life but the life we give them. They have no power except the power that we hand to them. If we get a mind or an emotional nature that starts and rants and raves until it finally takes over our lives, we are suffering from an internal case of dictatorship. And some emotion or some attitude has become our private Castro and has gradually put us into a hopeless situation of negation. Every time we get mad and tear something or throw something, we are just suffering from a problem of an internal Mr. Khrushchev. The moment he doesn't get what he wants, he throws things. We do the same thing, perhaps not quite so aggressively. But we are under the dictatorship of notions and opinions that have no right to rule anything. As long as those are left uncontrolled and undirected, we are under a tyranny, and the interior self-creative consciousness cannot operate. But we are never in this condition because we have to be. The only answer is we're in it because we want to be. We're in it because there's a certain emotional satisfaction in doing what we feel like doing, even though it may ultimately lead us to the electric chair or the gallows. If we have this feeling, we have to do it. Now, here's where our Oriental philosophy comes into this a little bit. Our Oriental philosophy says that any moment, in the middle of any tantrum, any temper fit, or at that time when we are most sorry for ourselves, or when we are most suspicious and critical of other people, we can stop it instantly if we want to. The question is, do we want to? We can stop it in several ways. We can't stop it by fighting it. We can't stop it by using a tremendous exertion of the will any more than we can actually control any person by force. We can get only at best a kind of eye service. We cannot make another person good by force, and we cannot make ourselves good by force. Therefore, the problem is that wherever a situation is out of hand, we are energizing the wrong value. Just take the energy away from it. Instead of kicking the machine, turn off the plug at the wall. That's the end of that program. I've heard people sit in front of television and complain for hours, shouting, groaning, and howling because the program was terrible. But not one of them thought to get up and turn it off. Because when you're in a problem as a sufferer, there's a certain satisfaction in suffering vastly and continuously. When we feel that we have a cause of complaint, the more complaining we can do, the better we feel about it. And we have wasted the life that we should be using to grow with. So wherever in our own inner life problems arise, there's no need or no real solution in trying to kick them around. The answer lies in turning off the energy. Because all of these things exist only because our own vitality sustains them. The moment we refuse to sustain them, they evaporate. They cannot survive without the energy that we give them by mental and emotional acceptance. Now, how do we turn off energy? Actually, it is a simple direct motion, and man today has very little experience in simple direct anything. Everything must be complicated. One of the simplest ways to prevent a situation from continuing to go out of hand is simply to place in the spot where it was something else. If instead of continuing to energize something we don't believe in, we turn and start to do something we do believe in, we immediately reduce the energy allotment to the negative thing. The moment we do something that is constructive, we use the energy which we are now allowing to tyrannize ourselves. So self-purpose of a constructive nature does take this energy. And one way in which self-purpose becomes available to us is through creativity. Self-purpose means that the contented individual is using his energy for some constructive purpose. Now, this constructive purpose may not be vast or particularly tangible to other people. The old farmer sitting with his chair backed up against the porch, quietly whittling a stick, was doing something that he wanted to do. Now, it wasn't very important, but it was much more important than criticism, much more important than self-pity. Perhaps he was making a new handle for some implement on the farm, making it as they had to make it. Today we buy the handle and save the time and worry with it. So all we do is buy ourselves more time for the creation of negative attitudes that we don't want. But wherever a negative thing comes along, there is the possibility of the substitution, quiet substitution,
of a constructive activity. We have to be aware of it, however. We have to be sufficiently desirous in order that we make this substitution. We also have to be observing, as we would be with a child. We have to know that when the time is right to make suggestions to self, and we have to make the suggestion clearly and follow it up. It cannot be a generality that sometime we'll do better. It has to be an immediate, concrete thing at the time when the need arises. In a very short time, this auto-correctivism, which we set up as a conscious process rather than as a subconscious one, also gains habitual authority. We can have good habits just as we can have bad ones. And if we will discipline ourselves for 6 months against our own negations, we will at the end of that time have an automatic self-discipline which will carry us through most of the minor emergencies and will only cause us to be consciously watchful in some major situation. We can also discover and observe the causes of these things. We can gradually try to correct causes. If certain situations that are unpleasant to us are constantly revived by a certain condition, we can go to work also on the condition itself, trying to put it in order so that it will no longer cause trouble. But merely to correct condition, as far as I've been able to observe, has never corrected the tendency to negative habits. The moment one cause is removed, the mind turns and grasps on something else and makes a new cause. So it cannot be merely the removal of the problem. It is not only that, but it is also the redirecting of our own energy. Now, if we don't fight with it, if we don't say, this thought I shouldn't have, I'm just not going to allow myself this thought, if we get all over this type of defense mechanism and simply turn to something constructive and interesting and take over, this negative thought simply dies a morning. There's nothing to sustain it. Now the person needs, therefore, something of a constructive nature, something active on which he can turn his attention at these critical moments. And there, of course, is where your self-creativity again comes in. It has to be something that calls upon energy. Our worrying is causing us to call upon energy. It is causing negative energy. We must therefore have a positive call upon energy, a positive plan or purpose, which we can call upon almost immediately when a negative situation arises. If we get a little tired or a little worried or a little nervous, we can go over down and sit down quietly at the piano and play for 15 minutes. The chances are our mood will change. We're not saying we won't worry. We're simply saying we will play the piano. But we are using energy. And the energy that we're using for that purpose is no longer available to nurse some grievance. We can be busy and miserable, but we cannot have creative instinct without this moving in upon our common patterns and causing something valuable to happen. It is to evade, if possible, of course, the complete monotony by means of which we do not gain this mental relief. We can do certain things with our hands and still worry, but we cannot have great creative ideas and still worry. So there are things that every person can attempt to do, and the Orient has shown us what some of these things are. One thing, of course, if it is possible, is the garden, where we can build a little world, a world of beauty that challenges us and which causes us perhaps to read about it, study it, maybe take lessons, and finally to apply what we have learned to the ordering of our own life. If our situations do not permit gardens, there are worlds in a flat dish on a table. This is your bonsai tree theory of the ancients, the sand garden, the rock garden, the garden that is only 12 inches square and which is yet a continual challenge to our own instinct to the beautiful. It's not easy to work with living things and at the same time hate people. It is not easy to have beauty a power in your life and then think unbeautifully. You can do it by theory, but if your hands are working with beauty, if you are continually trying to do things creatively, if you are trying to take a pattern and make it better, it calls upon energy. And this energy gives you a forward-looking emotional experience. There must be in every person's life some creative self-expression. If there is nothing that we can do, then it is certainly indicated that even at the expense of some time, we should study something. Not that leads only to intellectual satisfaction, but leads to action. There must be something that gets the hands occupied in creating a thing which calls upon our own inner resource. You can study books for a lifetime, for example, in trying to prepare a miniature garden. I'm now thinking of one of the little table gardens. You can read all the books and take all the courses. And then you bring in a handful of little twigs and stones and some sand and a rock or two and perhaps a little porcelain figure and some blossoms. And you will never find in any book just what you have to do with these things you have brought in and laid on the table alongside of you. You can copy as best you can, but your little twigs are not the same shape. You have to do something yourself. You have to satisfy your own taste. You put these things together, you think they're marvelous, you take a little separate look about 5 feet, and you say, how could I have ever done anything as badly as that? And you rush back and try and do it again. You may wear out 2 or 3 bones and half the rocks before you get anything that you can honestly say satisfies your own soul. But when you do, something has happened. You have had a small mystical experience. The beauty in you, the truth in you, has had a chance to come out and do something. And in the process of this alchemy, all of the particular problems of the moment have disappeared for a little while at least. And if we took all the time we negatively waste in worry, fear, doubt, self-pity, and things of that nature, and put this time into a lump somewhere, it would provide us with the opportunity, time-wise, of becoming masters of almost anything. But you are now trying to make something happen. You are trying to create. You may be trying to create a beautiful poem. You may be trying to create a marvelous picture. You may be trying to create a design on a loom. You are trying to create a new pattern. Wherever you are creating, you are releasing. And the thing you have created becomes the judge of your own release. You look at it, and it isn't what you thought it was going to be. It is not nearly as beautiful as your idea. So you keep on working with it. You keep on releasing beauty until finally you produce something which may not be perfect, but you will say, this I can endure. This indicates I've accomplished something. So life becomes a release of creativity. You will find, of course, that once the door is open, along this gateway or roadway of creativity comes quite a troop of different values. This open door to creativity also becomes more and more a way to the inner life of yourself. You have opened the road. You have repaired it. Perhaps the thing that comes across at first is merely a sense of order or proportion or value or color. But gradually, through this road that you have built, the whole inner life will move into manifestation. Because you have made the expression of your own consciousness important to you. And it is this expression of self-consciousness that must be understood. Now you can see that the production of something protects us against the wrong level of consciousness coming through. You cannot create a beautiful picture or a beautiful plant by calling upon your own negative opinionism. You cannot say, in looking at some charming thing which you have produced, you cannot say, my selfishness did this. You cannot say that this beautiful flower arrangement exists because you don't like someone, or that you're critical of people, or that you are sorry for yourself. This arrangement came as a result of something much deeper than that. And if it did, by any chance, become over-influenced by some negative phase of your personality, the design will be wrong. And your own eyes will tell you that it is wrong. And your own nature will reject it because it is wrong. And you will quietly create your own censorship. And you will learn the same in many fields of creative expression. And once this creativity is moved away from selfishness into the pure expression of its own nature, you will find it available in religion. You will find it available in moral thinking. You will find it assisting you in your physical responsibilities, helping you to recognize the problems of the time and how to face them. But you have to get the road open. And the only way we know of releasing the internal is releasing it into action. We cannot release it merely into thought. Because the fact that it moves into action causes it to do things. The moment it does something, we know whether it is true or not. If it never comes into action, what we thought was a beautiful idea might only be a concealed form of our own selfishness. But when it moves into action, it either produces good action or not good action. Instantly, we know whether the force itself is good or not good. This is why it has to move into activity. And throughout all of our ways of life, self-creative activity has been important. It is still important in the cottage industries of India. It is still important in folk art, upon which all fine art developed. It is important in the dance and the rhythm of primitive people. They are expressing. And here, we sit back in a rather sophisticated way and let machines do all our thinking for us. And because they're not very good at it, we live on the level of a mechanistic inspiration, which is not sufficient. But we can fight through these things and create laws unto ourselves, whereby we can daily observe the degree of our own creative expression. And because we try everything, we weigh all things and cling to that which is good. And for man, the weighing is the using. And by using, we discover whether we were right or not. We give some advice to somebody. He follows it and he's worse off than he was before. But we've moved away from the picture and we don't feel any responsibility. We justify ourselves on the grounds that he probably didn't follow the advice correctly or he should have worked. And we don't even stop giving the same advice to someone else. But if we give this advice to ourselves and it hurts, we're going to stop. We're going to find some other answer. So on our own skin, we have to test all things. And that which produces for us a newer, better, richer way of life, richer in real value, that is the way that we will ultimately cultivate. And our creativity gives us the power to break through this superficial personality and release architectural, archetypal force. And if we do release it in an archetypal experience of creative expression, we have the great design. We have the wonderful fabrics of India and Persia. We have the wonderful ceramics of China and Korea. We have the glorious lacquers and carved ivories of Japan. We have these things because in those days the simplest problem was one of creative expression. If we ever want to solve our problem, we've got to get this personal creative expression back into ourselves so that everything we do is meaningful. And even when we buy meaning, not just objects. We have become more careful, more thoughtful, more discriminating. And out of this comes a better life for all of us. Time is up. Time is up. Now,